Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. First one in the list is GPA, and then there's GPGme, and I'm kind of lumping them in together. I kind of wish I had noticed them at the end of the previous episode, because I would have just thrown them in at the end of the previous one. I was, of course, talking about GNU PG2 at the end of the previous episode. Love GPG2. Highly recommend it. Well, GPA is a GUI interface for GNU PG, which I guess I probably knew it existed, but I keep forgetting about it. And you might remember in a previous episode I spoke about Cleopatra, spelt with a K. Comes with KDE, and that's similar to this. It's like a keychain kind of manager which has access to your GNU PG keychain. So this is similar, except it's a GTK application, and I don't know actually who sort of puts GPA out, but this is the GNU Privacy Assistant, and I guess I can find out. GPA 0.10.0 is by the, it's got a link back to GNUPG.org, so I guess this must be like part of the official sort of distribution of this, so that's cool. You launch it, you know, I mean, like I say, it's a GUI, so you go to your application menu, or however you get there, your K menu, your start menu, whatever you call it, and GPA is what that's how I got there, GPA, and it opens up a window that lists your keys in your keychain. Now that includes your secret key, remember that's the one that you create for yourself and keep to yourself, as well as public keys that you have imported. You can tell them apart somewhat, well, not somewhat. You can tell them apart. Well, no, somewhat. Okay, so to the left of a secret key, there's an icon with two little keys, one golden key and one plain key, but it's more important that there are two there. That means there is a private and a public part of that key, while, the imported keys that you've brought in, you know, from other people, from like a key server, those are just, they only have one key icon, meaning that they just have the public part. But then there are other keys that you may have, depending on your activities, that have private and public parts, possibly for other uses. For instance, I've got a KDE Plasma desktop key here that belongs to me, but it belongs to me because it is the thing that locks my desktop information, you know, and prompts me for a password. So even though it's labeled KDE Plasma desktop, that's not like an official KDE Plasma desktop key. That's a key that I've created within my Plasma desktop to manage private information. So that's all of my keys in my keychain. And from this interface, I could quite easily and quickly, for instance, delete this revoked one that I'm now seeing from Ludovic Cortels at GNU.org. It's a revoked key. Don't really need that anymore. So I could right-click on it, delete that key. Says, am I sure that I want to do this? Yep, I'll do that, and now it's gone. Simple as that. And if you saw revoked keys in there, you know, after using this for a while, you might choose to do that as well, to get rid of them. So this is the that's the interface for GNU PG. You can do a lot through this interface. You can import a key if you've gotten a key from someone. Some people attach their public key that they want other people to have to their emails, usually as a .asc file, sometimes as a GPG, but generally the keys are .asc, and you could import that. You could download it to your computer and then go to keys, import keys, and then find that file on your computer. Or you could create a new key. If you haven't created a key along with me in the previous episode, you can just create a key with a little, like, you know, a little wizard, a little thing that'll, not a literal wizard, a GUI wizard that'll step you through the process. You can select once you've created that, you can send a key. So if there's a key that you haven't sent up to a server, to a key server yet, select it in the GUI, go up to the server menu and do send keys, and that'll send that key up to the server, and so on. It's a very handy application. It's very nice. And I think that's one of those applications that, yeah, I might never use it, but it's important to have. It's just such a nice feature to have, because if we want people to start using GNU-PG, then part of that is going to be giving people the option to interface with that application in a way that they feel comfortable. So, you know, sometimes, really, you heard how you have to use GNU-PG2 in the previous episode. You have to kind of know what questions to ask. Like, just to send your key up to a key server, you need to know its little fingerprint or whatever. I mean, there are other ways, but I mean, you have to have information about the key. And in order to get information about the keys, you have to do --list --secret-keys. And in order to find out that option, you have to read the man page. And the man page is not short, etc. So some people just can't quite, they're just not there in their terminal usage. Having GPA or Cleopatra, but in this case GPA, because that's what we're talking about, right there, you can tell them, launch that, go to the key menu, create a new key. Once you do that, click that key, go to the server menu, send keys. Now they're set up. They're set up to use encryption, cryptography. They can close GPA, never think about it again. They can open up their Kmail or their Thunderbird. You can instruct them how to add the key to their email account. They're done. They're good to go. I mean, every business should be doing this. Why wouldn't every business do this? Everybody should do this. And I know you're thinking, well, no, not everybody should do this, because some people don't email about anything that needs to be private. It's not a big deal. That is, there's validity to that. You know, like, there really is. It's for this, the same reason I really didn't like SSL for a very long time, because it's just like, you don't need SSL for every single website. Not all websites need, you know, a static website with trivial information on it. You don't really need that level of secure connection, but actually you do. Like, it's a feature to have that. And the more and more big companies start to abuse, to ignore robots.txt and start to scrape the web for various things, the more important it is to just encrypt stuff that you don't necessarily want to feed into an engine that you're not being alerted, paid for, that you're a part of. So it's a good idea to use GPG, or, as the case may be, GPA. So what's this GPGme all about? Well, that's a library. That's the API version, if you will, of GNU-PG. And when I said in the previous episode, I think I said it, unless I cut it out, but I said in the previous episode at one point that I tended to use GPGme more often than GPG2, and I guess I was speaking out of turn. I don't know for a fact off the top of my head that Kmail uses GPGme, so I probably, maybe I was wrong. But I have a feeling that that's what they're using, GPGme, because that's the library support for GNU-PG. GPA is probably using GPGme. I guess I could always find out by doing an LDD on user bin kmail. Is that valid? Yep. And then I would have to do a grep for GPG. Yeah. libgpgme, libgpgme.so.7.11, libgpg-error. So yeah, there are three libgpgmes for Kmail, and then I'm going to bet that GPA also uses libgpgme. Yes, it does. So anytime you're interfacing with an application that has GPG, or yeah, GNU-PG support, it's probably using GPGme. GPGme is GPG made easy, or GNU-PG made easy, I guess, and it's what you're going to find in your applications and what you would want to use were you to write an application that needed to interact with GNU-PG. That's that, I think. That's all the GNU-PG stuff. Yes, it is. Let's talk about htdig now. Htdig is a internal search engine. It'll index your website, but it's meant for like your intranet. You would not want to run this, for instance, on the internet where a billion sites exist. This is for your organization or your home. If you're storing stuff within your Apache server, you've got stuff, you know, HTML documents, TXT documents, I don't know, whatever kind of document. You've got that stored across your network. HTDig can crawl your network and discover all those files and index them, just like a web crawler does, and then you can search. It's pretty interesting. I mean, it's definitely a technology that is important, I think, for the modern state of digital files. We all need that kind of thing, I think. But I don't know how up to date it is. Certainly, it was last released, according to its website, it looks like the latest release was in 2004, so 20 years ago, if that's correct. Maybe there's just an update that they didn't post or something like on the website, but you know, sometimes they're more active in their Git than their HTML, so I don't know how sort of modern technology this is leveraging, but it does exist, and it's a thing that you can activate. It takes a little bit of configuration, but let's go through it real quick. So first of all, you have to start a web server. So on your machine, you can do a sudo chmod plus x slash /etc/rc.d/rc.httpd. That's the start script for your HTTP daemon, which is Apache in this case. That's the command to make that executable. Then you can do sudo space slash etc slash rc.d slash rc.httpd space start. And that starts your web server. We'll have to restart it in a minute, but I just wanted to get that up and running. So now if you go to a web browser and you type in localhost and go there, you see a message that says it works. That's the only document in your website right now, literally, an index.html file. You can cat var www slash, well, slash var slash www slash htdocs. That's where Slackware keeps its HTML documents for your web server by default. So slash htdocs slash index.html. It's one line of code. HTML body h1. It works. Close. Okay, that's it. That's a pretty small file to run this test on. Just for kicks, I'm gonna do a curl command to add to our data set. So curl, where's my curl? There it is. Curl /index.html-o/index.html-o/var/www/htdocs/gnu.html. All right, great. Now we have two files in our little web server. That's good. We're not ready to go yet. Well, we could proceed now. Okay, so now to run htdig, you have to list, or the only way I could get it to work was I listed the URLs I wanted it to crawl. I don't know that I'm doing this correctly. I kind of feel like maybe I'm misunderstanding the sort of the prompt here, but you can do sudo htdig space. Well, no, first you have to list your URLs. So if you just do echo quote /localhost/index.html:redirect into url.txt. And then echo the same thing, except instead of index.html, GNU HTML, and then redirect. You don't want to write over that same one. You want to append this to the end of the file, url.txt, cat url.txt. Yes, I have two lines, one on each, localhost index, localhost GNU. That exists. Okay, now you can do sudo htdig url.txt space dash S, just for kicks. Dash S is for status or statistics or something like that. It'll show you a little bit more output than the default output. Okay, there it goes. It indexed that quite quickly. Quicker than you'd think, but I mean, it is just two documents, so it's actually not that quick. I mean, or it is quick, but it's not that big of a deal that it's that quick. So presumably, and it's got statistics there, so it crawled two documents, it sent three different requests, and so on. So it did something, and now if you look at the man page of htdig, it doesn't really, like, tell you sort of what the next step in this process is. And if you look at the documentation in user doc slash htdig blah 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 readme, that doesn't really explain a whole lot either. So through extrapolation, eventually you get down to the end of this document, and maybe you might go to some other man pages. Eventually you'll get to this concept of HT search. But if you do a man page for HT search, man HT search, oh, that's hilarious. Now it exists. I swear to you, all afternoon, I've been doing man page HT search, or man HT search, and it hasn't existed. I swear to you. And now, suddenly, it works. Okay, well, how convenient for this episode that this all of a sudden works. HT search. Actually, it's not that bad, because it doesn't really say a whole lot. There's not a whole lot to this. Okay, anyway, what I actually did when I was trying to figure all of this stuff out was I went to /var/log/packages/htdig and did a search there for HT search. And there isn't an HT search, like, binary. It just doesn't, it's not, like, there's a bunch of other HT, like htdig, htfuzzy, htdump, htload, htmerge, htnotify, htpurge. But when you, if you really look for HT search, eventually you'll get to var /cgi-bin. Now that's the CGI folder for, I don't know what CGI stands for. It's not the computer graphics one. It's whatever else it stands for. CGI, it's scripts that run on a web server. A lot of times they're written in, like, scripting language, like Perl and Lua, and I think you can even do them in Bash, like PHP, right? Surely. Maybe not. Maybe. No, of course you can, PHP. So CGI-bin. So HT search is like a binary, actually a compiled binary. So if you do a file on /var/www, what was it? CGI-bin, HT search. It tells you that it's an ELF 64-bit LSB executable. That's admittedly a little bit odd. That you don't, usually it's in something else. I think of them as Perl scripts, really. And I think Apache kind of traditionally has as well. I mean, that doesn't mean that's the only thing that exists. It just means that that's what I think of them as. Okay. So anyway, we've run HT search, or rather HT dig. We know that a thing called HT search exists. So if you go to your web browser and log into your virtual machine first. There you go. If you go to your web browser and open up localhost, you see the it works file. But if you go to localhost /htdig/search.html, there we go, you see a little search engine, a little private personal search engine. It says this search will allow you to search the contents of all publicly available www documents on this site, and there's a little search field and everything, and that's really cool. Now if you type in, for instance, we know that it said that our web page had the word it works on it. We just saw that. So if you search for that right now, you get a little pop-up window offering to either save the file or cancel. And if you save that file, you look at it, it's a binary file. You don't, it's weird. It doesn't, what's happening is that it's calling, it's making a call to HT search, and then it's just letting you download that file, which isn't helpful at all. You want to actually run HT search. Okay, so the usual culprits here are, well, okay, maybe the file that we're trying to execute isn't capable of being executable. Okay, well, let's take a look at that. ls-l /var /www/cgi-bin /htsearch. No, It's completely executable. RWX. So it's executable by everybody. So what's really happening here? Well, what's really happening is that Apache doesn't know to treat this as a CGI file. So you have to go into your configuration file, /etc/httpd. Where's your configuration file again? /etc/httpd/httpd.conf. And here you need to, first of all, load a module to process CGI. So there's two stanzas, two locations that you have to do this at. So there's, it's already in the configuration file, it's just commented out. So if module lmpm_prefork_, that's not an L, that's an exclamation mark. So if it's not npm prefork module, then uncomment load module, cgid_module, lib64, httpd modules, mod cgid.so. And then if module npm prefork module, do the same thing, uncomment load module. So you're loading that module. I don't truly understand why I'm doing it twice, like the npm prefork and not npm prefork. I bet if I spent more time troubleshooting this, which I'm not going to, I could probably narrow down which one actually is required. I believe it's the npm prefork that would be required. But, I mean, it doesn't hurt to load it either way, I guess. There's probably a... What I'm saying is there's a better way to do it, but I'm not going to bother trying to figure that out right now. So, now we need to... So if you read through the configuration file, you do see eventually that there's a script alias directory /srv/httpd/cgi-bin. This location is where all your CGI scripts go. And it's like a centralized location for Apache to look at when a CGI script is called. So you do allow override. So you need to create a new block of code here. That's <= directory quote /srv/httpd/cgi-bin close quote >. Allow override none options +exec cgi -multi-views +symlinks if owner match order allow, deny allow from all set handler CGI-script. That's important too. So the set handler is ensuring that we're not mistaking what kind of file this is. And then you can close this entry. So that would be \\directory>. I feel like I did one more thing and now I'm not remembering what that was, but I didn't. No, that's all I did. Yeah, okay. So those are the two changes that I made. Simple. I'm almost sure that those are the only two. Yes, those are the only two. I'm looking really quick, just kind of cheating and looking. Okay, great, cool. So we've made an update to the configuration file. We've activated the CGI module, and we've sort of set what to do within the CGI directory for Apache. So now back to reloading. We need to reload this file, and you can do that with sudo /etc/rc.d/rc.httpd/restart. That restarts the Apache server. Should be good to go. Can't see anything possibly going wrong at this point. Okay, so we go back to the website, to localhost /htdig/search.html. We reload the page just for good measure. Type in the word work again, and we're going to click search, and this time it's definitely going to work as expected. No way it could go wrong. Click search, and it does not work. It wants to download htsearch again. Okay, so as it turns out, as I discovered, it's that Apache, and then there's probably a correct way to do this. I'm very confident there's like a right way to do this. There usually is. But Apache is not recognizing our HT search file, that little CGI script or binary, really, as a binary executable. It is, or rather, as a CGI bin, really. It thinks it is something else. I don't know. You know, it's looking for like a magic cookie at the start of the file, and it's not finding it. So, in other words, we just need to tell Apache that it is a CGI file and to run this thing. The quick and easy fix that I tried for this, and it ended up working, so why not go with it, is to symlink the HT search file to htsearch.cgi. So to do that, you would just do sudo, where's my command here? I guess I don't have it in my history somehow. Sudo ln-s slash var slash, no, actually, you know what I did? Just to make it even easier to get there, I think, slash SRV, so ln space dash s space slash SRV slash httpd slash CGI bin slash HT search. Go back to the beginning and just cut that and yank it back in. So we're doing slash space slash serve slash httpd slash CGI bin slash HT search CGI. Hit return. And now if you do a list of that file of that directory, SRV, HTTP, CGI, bin, then you see that there's an HT search and an HT search.cgi. And of course the .cgi one is just pointing right back to HT search. Will that work? Feels a little bit like a little bit hacky. But let's go back to our website here, reload it. Type in work in the search field, and then click search, and there we go. We got our little page, and it says that there is a page that contains the word works. In fact, it is localhost nothing. It just calls it localhost. I don't know why. But if I click on that, it takes me to the correct page, to the it works page. So what if we do bash? Search for the word bash. No matches. No matches were found for the word bash. Do I believe that? Do I really believe that? How about world? No results for world. So bizarrely, it doesn't... I'm not confident that it's looking at that GNU file, because now it's not even finding a GNU. So it feels a little surprising in the search results. So a bit of a mixed bag. Yes, it works, but maybe not exactly. That said, I spent more time trying to figure out how to get the web interface to work than I did, I guess, on trying to get the sort of the database in order, and I have a feeling that if I'd been able to spend more time, if the interface had worked quicker and, you know, reliably, maybe I could have had more time trying to figure out, okay, what do I need to, what magic phrase is it looking for the indexing to work correctly. And yeah, that just never really came about. So I tried running htmerge, thinking that maybe there was something having to do with the database, not, you know, for each document not being merged into one document, but I couldn't, that didn't seem to render any new results. I just couldn't get anything from the GNU.html file to show up. So mixed results, definitely. Like I say, though, it is an old little application. I mean, 2004 release date, kind of back there. I don't know. I mean, it seems like a useful thing. It does seem like a clever little application, but I think, yeah, in order in, you know, you'd have to mess around with it a little bit. The website configuration for someone who maintains web servers like all the time, probably actually the least of the confusion would be with that. Like, that would probably be pretty trivial. I'm certainly used to maintaining websites and dealing with CGI scripts, but they have always, I think they'd always been CGI scripts, like actual scripts, like Perl scripts, Python scripts, Lua scripts, whatever. I'd never seen an ELF binary, I don't think. Or if I had, you know, it's been in an environment where that's already been configured for me and I didn't have to worry about it. So that did take me a while to kind of figure that part of it out. I have a feeling that there's something simple about the way that I'm crawling that I could do to fix this and to get it to crawl GNU.html as well. But yeah, that's a project for another day. Should I ever decide that I want to take a search engine from 2004 and implement it on my local network? I think it's time for a coffee. And I'm back. I have coffee and I have another package to look at here. So the next package in this list is something that, I mean, I just kind of casually used in the previous package demonstration, and that is HTTPD. That's the web server. So HTTPD is HTTP daemon. That's what that is. And that's a really, really generic name, in a way, for something that is quite specific, and that is Apache, the Apache web server. That provides the HTTPD, or the HTTP daemon. Now, you can run a daemon that provides HTTP without running Apache. It's just that you won't be running HTTPD, you'd be running something else. And to be perfectly honest, a lot of times that something else is sufficient. Like, you might not actually need the Apache web server. There are other web servers out there that you can run. I guess in a way they're getting fewer and fewer as time goes on, but I mean, certainly one of the popular ones for a long while, one of the alternatives was LightTPD. I forget how you're supposed to say that. Oh, lightly. No? Yes, lighty. That's how they want you to say it. Lighty. So lighty, LIGHT TPD is a lightweight HTTP daemon, so you could run that. There's Nginx. That is popular and was popular for a while, and that's the one that I've actually got the most experience with, is Nginx. That one was kind of a really lightweight file with a format for its configuration that I really, really liked. And I think the biggest argument against Apache web server is the configuration file, and I don't think that's a controversial thing to say. I think a lot of people would agree that Apache configuration files are, well, I mean, they're kind of unique. They do things a very specific way. Now, the good news is that Apache is quite well supported, quite popular, and usually, I mean, I have not seen an exception to this rule yet. Usually, when you install Apache from, you know, on any Linux distribution, starting, all you have to do to get a web server going is to start it. You just start the HTTP daemon, and now you have a web server running. It's not like something like Bind or DNS Mask, where you have to kind of go in and configure it beforehand just to see a proof of concept. You can get a pretty long way with just doing an install and a launch. Launching it, as we've seen in the previous, before the coffee break, is simply a matter of triggering the RC file provided by Pat Volkerding with Slackware, which is /etc/rc.d/rc.httpd, and then some argument. What's the argument? You can see for yourself, if you do a less on that path, on the rc.httpd, you can see that there are a couple of different arguments. There's start, and I'm just reading the right after the initial comments in that file. There's a case one in start, stop, force restart, restart, graceful dash stop. So those are your options. And when you do one of those, when you select one of those options, this little script in the rc.d directory makes a call to user sbin apache cuddle and issues a command that apache cuddle supports. Kind of as easy as that. To make your web server start automatically upon boot, the Slackware method applies, which is you just make this file that Pat has created /etc/rc.d/rc.httpd. You make that executable. So you do a chmod or a sudo chmod 755 on /etc/rc.d/rc.httpd. And from then on, because this is how Slackware operates, from then on, when Slackware looks in rc.d during boot, when it finds an executable file, it executes it with the whatever default option, probably everything is defaults to start, I would think, and that's the advantage of having this sort of structured rc.d structure, where even though this is just a simple, I mean, really, when you do start, all it does is it executes /usr/sbin/apache-ctl /k/start. This is not a complex script, and even though there are several other options, the file itself is only 44 lines of shell script code, and probably the top 10 of that is a comment block, so we're down to 34, and then of course there's a lot of padding because this is all embedded within like a case statement, so there are things like, you know, case names and semicolon to end the thing and so on. So I mean, it's a really, really simple script, but it's standardized within /etc/rc.d so that by default things can get started when something is executable. The other way to do that, like if you don't want to make your web server always activate when you boot, you can just do a one-time execution of that file with sudo space bash space /etc/rc.d/rc.httpd/start. And that executes the file on a one-time basis. To confirm that everything is as you would expect, you can open up a web browser and go to localhost. Just type in localhost in the in your URL bar and go to localhost. Of course, a web browser knows when you go to localhost that when you're typing in a website, it's gonna go to port 80 because that's where websites live, and so it goes to port 80 of your localhost and it finds a page that declares it works. That's it. So where are those files? Well, I mean, again, we kind of already saw a lot of this in the previous episode. Those are, I mean, not episode, before the coffee break when we were talking about the package. Those live sort of, I was going to say by default, and I guess that is true. By default, those are in /var/www/htdocs. And in that file, you find a page called index.html and some manual pages, actually, which is seems kind of useful, maybe. Yeah, that looks pretty useful. Lots of interesting stuff in there. So that's Apache web server files, or Apache is serving the files that it finds in var wwhdocs. Why does it serve the files there? Well, as you might imagine, it's in a configuration file, and the configuration file, the Apache configuration file, is in /etc/httpd, and the main file is /httpd.conf. And if you look through there, you can see how it defines. I mean, you have to scroll quite a lot, and there's a lot of stuff that's commented out, which, I mean, as you saw before the coffee break, is actually really, really useful, because sometimes, you know, you just want to activate something without really doing a whole lot of legwork to try to figure out where everything is and so on. So there's modules listed here that you can activate just by uncommenting, and then they're just on. So that's kind of nice, actually. I mean, it does clutter up the config file, but I mean, it is really useful. So somewhere in here, there's a definition of where the files live, and that's called the document root. And this is where it kind of gets interesting, and why I was kind of hesitating earlier when I was describing where these files lived. Because if you do a search in this file for, say, var/www, you won't find any reference to that. It seems a little bit odd. Well, the configuration file states, where it's describing what a document root is, it says the directory out of which you will serve. Boy, that's a lot of words to say the directory serving your documents. By default, all requests are taken from this directory, but symbolic links and aliases may be used to point to other locations, directories. Okay, so that gives us a hint. So if you do an ls-l in, actually I'm going to do l, no, let's just do just dash l, dash l, actually, okay, dash lh, why not? Less is more. Dash LH on, let's say serve/SRV, you discover that in /SRV, there are two, not directories, but symlinks to other directories. So there's a /serve/www that points to /var/www, and there's /serve/httpd, which points to /var/www. So /serve does exist. Like if you do an ls-l on just slash, serve is an actual directory. You see that truly, truly there at the root of your file system. But inside serve, there are just two symlinks that point right back out to /var/www. I don't actually know the purpose of that. That's not necessarily on every system, but it's an important thing to be aware of. Like, I mean, I don't know why Pat configured it that way, in other words, but it's an important thing to be aware of, because it does happen elsewhere, or similar things happen, I should say. Like, your document root isn't necessarily always /var/www, or if it is, it might be rerouted back to /var/www after a fashion, for whatever reason, maybe because to some people who are used to other systems, it would be in /SRV, or maybe it just seems like a sensible thing to do, or maybe that's the actual Apache default. I didn't read their documentation in a while, so maybe that's their actual default, but for whatever reason, Pat thinks that it makes more sense to go into /var/www. Or, I mean, that's probably not it, because usually Pat doesn't change stuff from upstream that much. So for whatever reason there is to make a symlink to this other location, that's a valid choice to make. And you might find on other systems that your www location is in user share, or you might find that it's in your home directory in a public_HTML subdirectory. So there are lots of possibilities here, and it just kind of depends on how the server admin has decided to configure Apache. Now, there are lots of other statements within an Apache configuration file that you can sort of modify and create. So the directory statement, which is in a it's not really XML, but I mean, at the same time, I guess maybe it is, because I mean, these are, well, it's not, but I mean, it sort of is. They're in like tags, and one of the tags is directory, and that's the tag that you use to create the document root. You close that tag, and now you're finished defining directory. You can also define how files are treated, for instance, how specific files are treated. Like here's a clause I see in the config, less than symbol files quote dot ht asterisk close quote close greater than symbol require all denied. What does that do? And then close file. So what does that do? Well, it prevents anything that starts with dot ht prevents anyone from getting there. So you can't, it's highly unlikely that you're going to be able to go to a website and type in, I don't know, gnuworldorder.info/.htaccess and find a file there. I should probably check that out, actually. Can you see anything like that? No, forbidden, it says. 403 forbidden. Okay, good. Got something configured right. So that can be important because .htaccess defines how things can or cannot be accessed. Htpassword puts a little password in front of a page, and so on. So that's kind of an important thing to configure. But I mean, it's all auto-configured here, and like I say, most distributions of Apache I've ever encountered, I mean, all that I have personally encountered, they're already pre-configured. They're ready to launch. Now, they might not be ready to launch with all of the details that you want them to launch with. So for instance, when you launch just a test instance of your Apache web server, you do get a warning in your terminal that it doesn't know what your fully qualified domain name is. And so, yes, you're running a web server, but as far as, like, Apache just sees that your domain is whatever your computer's host name and domain name happens to be, which if it's mybox.example.local, then as discussed in previous episodes, a .local address only exists on your network. People over the internet aren't going to be able to get to your computer, at least not without intervention from you. So for instance, you can do it that way. You can run a website on your computer, but as I've said several times before, but I'm going to say it again because it's important to remember, when you're doing something with network configuration, there are always at least two things to consider. Never just one. There's always at least two. One is your computer where you're doing the thing, but the other one is the network. If the network doesn't know about your thing that you're doing on your computer, then it just exists on your computer. So you've got a web server. You've got a domain name that just kind of got created somehow on your computer as you were installing things, and you didn't really think about it then, but whatever it is, right? Oh yeah, it's okay. It's mybox.example.local. Sure, big deal. Well, big deal because no one can get there, right? Because .local isn't an internet extension, top-level domain. So there are a couple ways to do this. The hacky way is to go to your router that connects you to the internet and put in a special rule on your router that anyone coming to the IP address of your router is then to port 80 of the IP address of your router is then redirected straight to your computer running the web server. Now, that's kind of weird because then people are going to an IP address, and so that doesn't seem very convenient. But I mean, they did get to your computer from the internet. You could go to go buy a domain name, assign it to your router, which is not a great idea because usually routers are dynamically assigned an IP address. So it changes probably every month or so, or 2 months, or every time you turn off your router or whatever. So that's not the best solution, but it is a solution. You can do that. You can get free domain forwardings from companies like, DYN, Dynamic Domains, DYM DNS or something like that. There are ways to do this. You can make it happen. It's just, it's a lot of, like I say, it's basically a hack. I guess you could use, OpenNIC as well. You could get your own domain, OpenNIC domain DNS, and point it at your IP's router, and then people going to that domain would again get forwarded to your computer and on port 80, and that would be the web server. So all of that is possible. It's just not the way that you're supposed to do it. The way that you're supposed to do it is to use the Apache conf file, and specifically there's a thing called a virtual host. And the virtual host is a setting that you create in an Apache conf file. I'll open this up in Emacs here. And a really basic version of this, first of all, is if you look in the Apache configuration file for the word listen. You see that indeed this web server is set to listen at port 80. It's right there in the, like, literally in the configuration file. It's already there, which is why if you did the hack, people would still end up at your, or if you just go to localhost, you end up at this web server, because this web server is listening on port 80, which is basically, you know, the default with very few exceptions. That's the default setting for anything that's going to the internet. They just, things look at port 80. That's the default. That's what they do. That's how, that got declared very early on. And so everyone knew, well, if I want to go to the internet, I'll go to port 80. Or rather, if I want to go to a website, I'll go to port 80, because that's where websites live. Okay, so listen 80 is set. What is not set, and let's look for this really quick, is server name. Let's see if there's even a slot for this. Yes, there is. Okay, cool. So somewhere in here, and I forgot to turn line numbers on less. Can I do that really quick? Yes, I can. I have to quit less, though, to do it, because for some reason... it does work. Okay, well, I don't like it that way. Okay, so the equal sign shows you the line number of your current position in less, but I prefer to just launch less dash capital N for line numbers, and then the file that you're looking at. Okay, so now I've got line numbers turned on. I'm going to look for server name. And that's line 224. So server name, capital S, capital N, server name, space, and then the registered DNS name, which would be www.example.com:80, for instance. So now you've given your server a name. You may also want to do a server alias. I don't believe that's in here anywhere. Server alias? No. So right after server name, if you want, you can put server alias, again, capital S, capital A, space, example.com. So all you're doing there is saying, yes, my domain name, the one that I registered with, you know, whoever, like whatever service I went to, is www.example. But everyone knows, no one wants to type in the three W's anymore, so just do example.com as well. So either of those will go to this, you know, Apache will understand, rather, that both of those servers live here. Now, it's important to realize that you are not, just as I almost misspoke, you are not letting the world know that the server example.com or www.example.com lives on your computer. You're just telling Apache to respond to requests for that name. You actually, to tell the world where example.com is, you have to go out to a DNS reseller and buy the DNS, you know, the name, the domain name. And then you set somewhere, usually with the place at the place you bought the name in the first place, although not always, but that's, they usually have a service for that. You have to set what IP address you want that name to go to. And so there in your DNS records, you would set example.com, www.example.com as the A name, to some IP address. Technically the IP address of your computer. And now if you don't have a public IP address on your computer, then you have to set it to the IP address of your router. And then you set in the router that anything coming to this port, to this IP address at port 80, gets forwarded on to your computer. And now your computer gets this request for example.com. Apache is listening on that port, on port 80. It reads that the request is for example.com, and therefore it presents the files in the document root, which of course has been defined, as we've already discussed, to the files in /srv/www, or said another way, because that's a symlink, /var/www/htdocs. That is more or less how the Apache server works. There's a lot more you can do with Apache configuration. You can do virtual hosts, so you can have it set up to where, yeah, your computer's listening on port 80, but it knows that several different domains live here, and so you can have a virtual host tag, specifically \virtualhost, capital V, capital H, space, asterisk, :80, greater than symbol. And then you can define a different document root. So maybe this one lives in var www/mysite, or maybe it lives in /home/clatu/public_html, whatever. And then server name, www.mysite.com, server alias, mysite.com, and then whatever else you need. So, and so you can have lots of different virtual hosts defined, and that way when someone comes to your router or your IP address, whatever, and looks at port 80 and declares which website it's looking for, Apache can switch and decide, okay, well, you're asking for example.com, so here's that page. Or, oh, you're asking for mysite.com, well, here's that page. And so on. So Apache Conf can get complex. I think it's kind of a big format. There's a lot of, sorry, I don't know. It just seems kind of big. There's just a lot to think about. Which maybe that's fake. Like maybe if you actually do it well without a bunch of comments in the file and you're just doing what you need, then I guess really it's not that big of a deal. But somehow, I don't know, Nginx has already always seemed just really, really simple to me. And it's just got this nice kind of almost a C style configuration file, which doesn't really make any sense. But I mean, you know, it's like statement, curly brace, all of your options, close curly brace, and that's it. Like it's just so simple. Or maybe it's a, I don't know, maybe it's a bracket, but I'm pretty sure it's a curly brace. And it's, yeah, it's really simple. That said, I mean, Apache is ubiquitous. I mean, it runs some of the biggest websites. So I don't dislike Apache. It's just in practice, I think I ended up defaulting to something a little bit simpler for lots of different reasons. One, just because of the configuration file, but also because sometimes I just thought that Apache was probably more than I needed, whatever that means, you know, and that doesn't really mean a whole lot, to be honest. But I guess when you're running things on a Pi, for instance, maybe sometimes you think, well, you know, like if I have to install Apache and it's, I don't know, make believe it's 24 megabytes. I don't know how big the Apache package would be on any given distribution, or Lighty, then, oh, I'll just, which is like, again, pretending here, 10 megabytes, then I'll go with Lighty, you know, so you just do whatever's less. And so maybe that's kind of how I fell into it as well. Either way, Apache web servers, they're a lot of fun to maintain. I think they're really intriguing. They always feel kind of significant because when you put it out there into the world, it is out there in the world. It's on the internet and nobody might visit your site. You know, like you might not get any traffic. You might have no reliable way of monitoring your traffic. You might not be interested in that, but it just feels like you've got your little booth up at the fair, and that's an exciting thing to have. It's the starting place of your, you know, sort of your digital presence, I guess. And running your own server is kind of a really fun way to mess around with things, because I mean, if you mess it up, big deal. It's just your own little server. Like no one's counting on you. So I think running an Apache site or a website with some HTTPD is fun. I think it's a great way to learn stuff. There's a lot of kind of testing that you can do that is just kind of built in, and a lot of it, as long as you're doing really simple stuff, there's quite a lot that you can do without really being too concerned about messing things. I mean, you can misconfigure Apache or your web server and you know, like, I don't know, open your entire home folder to the world. So I mean, don't, you know, like, it's not completely safe. You're still putting something out on the internet, so there is a risk involved. But as risks go, I think simple sort of flat file websites are among the not terribly risky compared to all of the other things that you could possibly do, like a mail server, like I kind of avoided talking about a couple of episodes ago. So yeah, try out a web server. It's a lot of fun. And if you're trying to learn web development too, I think having the ability to bring up and close down websites really, really quickly, like test websites, it's a great skill. Like I made a good living for a while just doing that for other people. And they were really appreciative. But at the same time, you know, sometimes I just thought, I couldn't believe I was getting paid for it, because it's just relatively simple to bring up a web server, install WordPress, or Drupal or whatever framework they were using and call it a day. And that, you know, that was it. That was all I had to do. And that was the job. And it was great. But it was kind of, or I mean, that was a segment of the job. It wasn't literally all I did, but it was a big component of it. And it was great. But it is, it's a skill. It's a serious skill. I mean, these days there might be related skills like, oh, you have to do all of that, but you're doing it in a container or whatever. But I mean, it's still, it's something that people need as they learn web development, or that you might need as you learn web development. And it's, there are packages out there, there are applications out there to that try to make it super easy for people, you know, like there's LAMP stacks and MAMP stacks and other abbreviations that provide an icon on a web developer's desktop so that they can double click it and it starts the thing and it does all of the thing, you know. It's just, I don't know, I mean, that does work sometimes, but it also in a weird way, sometimes it's just over complex. If you know what you're doing, you can just make a couple of changes to a configuration file, restart a daemon, and you're done. So try it out. If you've never done it, at least launch Apache when you get home today. If you've never launched your own web server, just launch sudo bash etc rc.d rc.httpd start, and then open your web browser, go to localhost, look at the it works symbol or the it works message, and then quit and stop sudo bash etc rc.d httpd stop. There, you're done. You've at least created a web server now. And that is it. That's it for this episode, but it's also all of the H's in the N section, so we're on to the I's next time. Thank you very much for listening. Talk to you next time. Thanks for listening. My name's Klaatu. You can reach me anytime over email with feedback or comments, tips, or just to say hi. My email address is klaatu@slackermedia.info. You can also reach me on the Mastodon network, not Klaatu, at mastodon.xyz. The show's intro and outro music is by Fat Chance Lester. You can find their music on bandcamp.com or on gnuworldorder.info. In the archive, you'll find a music directory containing the album from which this music has been extracted. Until next time, thanks for listening, and keep the source open.
Tastes like rocket fuel.